Welcome to SLA, where you can learn to avoid gaslighting yourself and your language teaching practices,
break down academic gatekeeping on second language acquisition,
and girl boss your way through dynamic, engaging, and research-based language teaching.
I'm Ben Fisher Rodriguez, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Bill Langley, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Brian Smith, and my pronouns are he, they.
Let's slay. All right. Well, welcome back to our next episode of SLA, Second Language Acquisition for Everyone. And today we'll be talking about the issue of corrective feedback in the language classroom. So what does it mean? And we'll be diving into a specific study that looks at the issue of feedback and learner uptake, what they do with the feedback in the classroom. So our first section is the gaslight section, where we're talking about some ideas or things that we've done in the past that have maybe not been the best, or some pitfalls we've run into when dealing with this topic. So just starting out, for me, when I think about the idea of corrective feedback, I just think back to myself as a language learner and like what my experience was like being in the classroom and having teachers who would give me oral corrective feedback during class. So what that means is, if you make a grammatical mistake or you use the wrong choice of vocabulary or whatever it is, the teacher immediately will lead you to the correct form. And there are multiple different ways that they can go about doing that that will be discussed in the article in depth. One, just as an example, one way is to just simply tell them what the correct form is. So if you say, I don't know, I go to the store yesterday, the teacher immediately would then say, I went to the store, to, you know, signal to you that you made a mistake. Or so they would have to signal when they do that, say like, no, the correct form is I went to the store. And then another way of doing that is to give a recast, which is where you basically repeat, the teacher would repeat what the student said, but with the correct form. So if the student said, I go to the store yesterday, then the teacher would immediately then say, ah, you went to the store. So that's what a recast is. And so when I was a student learning languages, I mean, I think a lot of us are probably able to relate to this, but I was kind of a grammar nerd. And so I wanted to be sure that I got everything correct all the time. And so I actually liked it when my teachers would, you know, correct, because I don't know, I was concerned with being accurate. And a lot of my, you know, assessments and things were based on grammatical accuracy when I was a learner in the classroom. But I did observe some of my peers in the classroom who really didn't seem to be into that. You know, I can think of students saying things like, you know, I'm not a natural language learner, I just don't have the aptitude for it. And I think, I wonder if some of those attitudes could have been formed based on the kind of feedback that they got from their teachers. And, you know, if you're constantly being corrected, that might kind of cause you to believe that maybe you are constantly going to make mistakes, when we know that as a second language learner, it's natural to use what you know, which may not always come out as what is considered to be completely grammatically accurate by a native speaker or an educated native speaker. And so, yeah, like, even just thinking about the process of learning your first language, babies, children, they don't start out having perfect grammar. It takes a lot of time for them to acquire that. And it's the same with our second language learners. So I think a lot about how attitudes about language learning are formed through feedback. So from that, I guess in that vein, going back to kind of when I was first starting out as a language teacher, I had learned a bit about oral corrective feedback in my teacher preparation program. And so the ideas were kind of bouncing around in my head, but I wasn't really sure, like there was no real clear recommendation about like what I should be doing in terms of what kind of feedback to give. So I thought it was important for students to know what the correct forms were. So I would often, you know, give them explicit feedback and say like, no, this is the correct form, or I would use recasts a lot. And just spent a lot of time out of the lesson doing that. And I found that, you know, sometimes students were appreciative and other times they either were not, and they kind of shut them down from participating in the discussion, or they just simply, you know, ignored it, or, you know, they didn't seem to uptake that feedback and incorporate it into their control of the language. And since then, I've learned a lot more about the ideas of teaching with comprehensible input and focusing on communication in the classroom. And so I don't I mean, I do still give oral corrective feedback, but definitely not as often or as frequently as I used to before. And I'm really sensitive to how students are feeling while they're in the classroom because it's so important for them to have a lower effective filter and, feel safe, comfortable to say, speak their minds and comfortable to make mistakes. So, any thoughts on this
I
that
think
you
it,
have?
yeah, I'm totally with you. I think the setup of our classes, like, I was just thinking about, like, what is the purpose of learning a language? It's probably because you want to, like, tell somebody something or, like, make a friend or something. And so I think when I can imagine a learner going in, it's been a while for us since we started learning our languages, but I can imagine going into it being like, one day I'm going to be able to, like, shoot the breeze with my friends who also play this video game in German. And how cool is that? And if, like you said, Brian, if like the only feedback you're getting early on is like, that's nice that you told me a thing, but it was wrong. So like, wrong, like accuracy wrong. When you're like, I was just trying to tell you something, right? Like, did you, it's like when you are in a discussion with someone and they hear something entirely different than you were saying, and how frustrating that is. Even if, like, this happens in first language, in like friendships and relationships, or like, this person heard something else when I said this. And so that's how it can kind of feel as like a learner, is if you're trying to be like, I just want to tell you that I like to play tennis. And you're like, actually, you said that wrong. Even though I'm like, I'm pretty sure you knew what I was trying to say. Like, I was just trying to tell you something interesting about myself. And you essentially said no back to that. That can be very frustrating and relationship breaking. I think of even now, like, I am an advanced speaker of German. People, language teachers are generally, in order to be certified by their state, are advanced speakers. So, like, we all can absolutely 100% more than survive in our countries. And I still get so, like, shut down if somebody I don't know gives me some sort of oral corrective feedback in the middle of, like, us having a discussion about anything. Because, again, I was like, we're just two people. And I was just trying to essentially meet you and, like, make a relationship or exchange information. And you were focused on my language, which makes me self-conscious about my language. I have some friends who I've told, like, when I've gone to Germany to improve my language skills or kind of see more culture or travel or that sort of thing. I have a couple of friends who I will tell directly, hey, like, I'm trying to get my German, like, even better. If I say something weird, just like tell me. And they're very generous about it and they're kind and stuff like that. But I also asked for that. Again, I think most people in learning a language are learning it to use it for some sort of goal in their life that brings them joy and satisfaction. And so, again, if we couple that, like, ooh, isn't learning a language fun, with just a lot of no, then yeah, these kids are not going to want to keep learning the language. They're going to associate that feeling with being chided. Even as gentle as we can be as teachers, it still feels like a, oh, actually, I'm going to slow you down there. Like, oh, wrong, like, wrong. And I don't want that to be the alarm bell ringing in my kid's head while they're going for it, trying to speak. I would say that too, like, I have, in changing to proficiency-based teaching, have kind of held off on teaching explicit grammar in quotation marks, kind of as long as I could, until, I was in a program that, some sort of college credit program that was like, you should teach grammar. And I was like, okay. But I held off as long as I could so kids had language proficiency base from which to work. And it happens every year where, like, I'll introduce a grammar term and the kids are like having a hard time grasping it in English, the kind of metacognitive and meta linguistic sort of terms that we use for grammary stuff. And so they will go through this phase of, like, coming out of level two, they're just like, blah, 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 and the language, like, yapping it up. And then all of a sudden I'll be like, did you know that grammar terms exist? And they get shy again and they get, like, weird about their language proficiency. And I'm thinking of podcasts that we love, which is the Motivated Classroom podcast by Liam Printer. Talks about, what drives the car of motivation is competence, autonomy, and relatedness. And if you're taking hits to your competence repeatedly by being like, I don't know this thing about the language I want to speak. I don't know it. I don't know it. I don't understand it. I don't get it. Why is it like that? Then, yeah, that's going to make a big hit into your motivation as well. So I try to hold it off as long as I can and make sure that I have a base of language from which to work. But even then, kids kind of go through this, like, phase where all of a sudden they get real shy again, in the same way that they were kind of more in, like, level one. So, Bill, what you thinking? Well, I think you all have wonderful, beautiful points on how we make kids feel and, like, their motivation. And, I think it's, you got to have that, like, relationship with students. of course, for them to not think that you're just telling them how wrong they are every single time they speak. And like some other maybe not necessarily effective filter, but could be effective filter related stuff. I think that an issue that we sometimes have also is assuming that all forms of corrective feedback are appropriate for every student all the time. So I don't think we've talked explicitly yet about order development, but essentially, is the student actually ready for the correction of their error anyway? So I know in Spanish, the biggest feature that has been studied in order development is ser en estar. If you're not a Spanish speaker, both of those words mean to be, but are used differently. And like there's a very well documented process that students go through as they're developing accuracy with using these two verbs. So I think that's, and I think that's been studied. I've read it from Van Patten. And it's just very well defined. And so if we're always going to correct students, like, oh, we should use a star here, when their brain just hasn't put all of the pieces together yet, their brains haven't had enough evidence of when to and not to use these words yet. So, yeah, keeping in mind that not all students are ready for the same feedback all the time.
Totally. That, like, I think instead of the start, like, whether or not you explicitly tell kids the uses of one or the other, or I keep saying kids because we're all, high school, secondary teachers, but, whether you tell learners, ser is used for this and start is used for this, those learners are going to go through the same stair step, essentially, progression of using them. One might say, incorrectly or not standard usage wise, as someone who acquires the language, like, naturalistically, we might say. So just absorbing it implicitly through just comprehensible input. So, like, yeah, if you do a bunch of correction, it won't bypass that. So, totally.
Yeah. And it kind of like, brings me back to the monitor hypothesis by Stephen Krashen, where students need to first be aware of a rule and also have enough proficiency in the language and time to apply the rule to correct their own language or repair their mistakes, if you want to call them mistakes. So if they don't have all of those ingredients, error correction really isn't going to be that useful for them. So they can't employ their monitor in that sense.
Totally. We can do all we want. And then will it bring anything? That's a big question mark. They're still just going to develop how they're going to develop. Is this a nice segue into ungatekeeping, some research about corrective feedback? So we read a study from Studies in Second Language Acquisition titled Corrective Feedback and Learner Uptake, subtitled Negotiation of Form in Communicative Classrooms. This is by Ranta and Leister. Lister?
Lister.
Lister, thank you. And so we read Lister and Ranta's corrective feedback and learner uptake. They were looking into kind of the fundamental questions of error correction as we see it in, applied second language acquisition and teaching the language in the classroom. And they were kind of looking at the big overarching questions kind of in error correction research are, should learners' errors be corrected? When should learners' errors be corrected? Which errors should be corrected? How should errors be corrected, and who should do the correcting? And they don't answer all those questions in this study. Those are just kind of the big five kind of overarching error correction universe. But in this study, they looked at what were the effects of using certain kinds of oral corrective feedback? Like, what did it actually do? So I'd say that probably answers or is attempting to point towards an answer to the question, like, how should errors be corrected? And perhaps by whom, because most of these, these were from the teacher. So the study was on four elementary school French immersion classrooms where students were receiving subject matter instruction as well as French language arts instruction in the language, in the target language. The different groups had different time lengths of exposure to French. Some had been taking one French lesson a year, or excuse me, a year, 1 hour of French a week, essentially, for a couple years or a day. I can't remember, but not a lot of French, you know, so some standard French lessons for a couple years and then switched to a dual immersion program. And some were full immersion from first grade on. And so the long and short of it is these are young people with lots of language in their head. They're getting their content matter, you know, their content instruction, their subject matter instruction, you know, geography and math and all that sort of stuff in the language. And if you walked by that classroom, I'm sure you would be like, those are French speakers doing French people stuff. And so the researchers took recordings of what the students were saying and then what the instructors were saying back to them, looking for when the instructors chose to make oral corrections to the things that the learners were saying, and then what happened after that. So the first thing was that, you know, the instructor perceived that there was an error. And so they, you know, there's some sort of grammatical something that is amiss, and the instructor perceives it. Then they decide whether or not they're going to correct it. And they don't always correct it, which that is just a fact of, you know, teaching in a classroom, and you just don't correct everything because you can't. And then they coded what the instructors, how they chose to correct the error that they perceived. And then after that, they coded how the student responded to that. They called it uptake in the article here, which uptake, I always think of in terms of SLA as like whether or not features or words or grammar or whatever are acquired in the, like, you know, subconscious language acquisition device moment in their brains. But in this one, their definition of uptake used for this study was whether or not the learner immediately did something with the corrective feedback that the teacher provided. So there are different, Brian kind of was alluding to this earlier, is there are different ways to do corrective feedback, and they listed out the major ways. And I think these are helpful for us to know as instructors because it kind of shows us the menu of choices that we have when we can decide to use, if we decide to use oral corrective feedback, what does it look like? There's explicit correction. That's one Brian mentioned, which is just like being like, no, say it like this, or like, no, this is what this is. That's just called an explicit correction. You're just telling them exactly how to say it, quote unquote, correctly. The next type would be a recast. Brian also mentioned that, which is taking a thing that was said with an incorrect form and then saying it again, but with the correct form. So just in the line of conversation, it's I go to the store. It's like, oh, you went to the store, or I went to the store, just to recast it for them. But usually the conversation moves on from there. Clarification requests. This is if someone says something, quote, erroneous, unquote, and the other interlocutor just goes, huh? Or like, what did you mean when you said this? Just trying to, it's like when communication breaks down and you're trying to figure out what exactly they meant. You could get metalinguistic feedback, which is the fourth type, which is like thinking about the specific features of language. You know, like, is that the correct article? Is that the helping verb we want to use, the auxiliary, blah, 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 that sort of thing. Elicitation is just, you know, saying, you know, opening up a space for a student to give a corrected response. You know, so if the example they gave in the study was like, the dog can runs, and then the teacher goes, the dog can runs, the dog can, and then waiting for the student to provide run instead as the, you know, infinitive or whatever. And then the last one is just repetition, just repeating what a student said if it was erroneous. You know, like, oh, you said el this, and when it's supposed to be la or something like that. So all that being said, these are different ways to provide feedback, and we kind of, I assume that we do a lot of these different ones in our language classes at different times. But so the crux of the study was which ones do something, which ones do learners do something with, but also they, you know, found data on which ones are instructors most likely to use. So the numbers are in, and in the tables provided, it seems like most language instructors are doing recasts. So they're simply saying what a student already said, but with a corrected form. So in the native-like way. That's what most teachers are doing. However, according to their definition of uptake, which is then doing something with the teacher's correction, that one had the least uptake in terms of how volume of what kids did with it. They most of the time, I think students perceive that to just be the teacher repeating an answer because they were interested in what the student said or wanted to, that's something we do conversationally all the time, is just, repeat what someone said to show we're listening or to kind of emphasize and sympathize, those sorts of things. So students really didn't really do anything with recasts. On the other hand, students do a lot with things like elicitation, where you are obviously opening for an answer, for a correction, for something. Oh, like the dog can, and the student has to respond because you're clearly waiting for them to make some sort of response. Overall, they had a chart in here that I found really interesting, which is just like, students make lots of errors as they're learning. They just do. That's just a part of life. We can't respond to all of them. Obviously, that would drive us nuts. But the ones that we do with these kind of choices of feedback, we weren't getting a lot of immediate repair or changing of the errors from students. And this was live in the moment conversation. Now, I had a lot of thoughts as I was reading this, is that the first one is that these are immersion students. They've had hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of input far beyond what I am able to provide in my 4-year high school program in terms of just pure hours, pure time. And so if these teachers are providing all these types of feedbacks and they're doing lots of recasts and they're not doing a lot of elicitation, but when they do, it gets a lot of, corrections out of the students, or at least uptake trying to repair. What, like, if they're doing that with students with a huge basis of language, should I even be doing this with my students who have a much smaller base of language to work out from? Should I spend the time learning metalinguistic terminology so I can do those sorts of corrections with students? Should I, expect them to respond to an elicitation if they maybe don't even have the words for it yet, if they're still acquiring their kind of base vocabulary? I am leaving the door open for Bill and Brian to kind of respond. Is just what I was reading in this is that there were some repairs, like some corrections to the correct form from some of these feedback types, but the percentage was so low in that moment that it just made me wonder if, like, it's a thing we should focus on very much. What was y'all's reading of the article and the results there?
Well, I'm just reminded of a quote, and I wish I could tell you who it was from. But I think maybe Brian has told me this before as well. But like, corrective feedback is helpful to some students in some situations sometimes. So it was something along the lines of that. But yeah, like, yeah, there are definitely going to be students that we've got that are going to be receptive. But is it enough to convince me that I should be doing it more? Not so sure. I think I do a fine job. Like, I do what I believe I should be doing, and in the moment when students say something that doesn't quite fit prescribed grammar, but is understandable. But yeah, I think all these things are really important to consider. And also, maybe I spaced out, I don't know if you already said it or not, but like, the lack of a post test, a postponed post test, which a lot of these corrective feedback, oral or written, articles don't have that post test, like, very removed from the experiment itself. So
Totally. Like,
just, I think a lot of things to consider. Yeah.
they might
A lot
repair it
of
in the moment, but do they
limitations.
use it correctly in the future as we would
Yeah.
want? Yeah, totally.
And it's really just so contextual too. I mean, the fact that these were, again, immersion students, and like, even just thinking about my own teaching, like, I give different kinds of feedback depending on the level. With my beginners, I basically never do like metalinguistic feedback or elicitation because they're not going to understand. They're not going to be able to produce the correct form because they don't know what it is. They don't have enough language. But with my upper level students, I do them all the time. Sometimes with success, sometimes not, but it seems like It doesn't, I think in the past when I have done more kinds of feedback like that with beginners, it seemed to shut them down a lot more than it does with the upper level students that I use it with now. And so, I mean, I think like we really cannot take a study like this and generalize it and say, like, oh, this is what everyone should do because this is what it said in the study. Like, it's really just like this specific context, this is what they found. And you know, like we said, it didn't go into the whether students were able to retrieve that uptake later on as part of a delayed post-test or something like that. Like we don't know. Like, does uptake only mean immediately in the moment doing something different with the form? Or do we care more about students, you know, being exposed to the language and not being discouraged from communication and eventually hoping that they acquire the correct form? I mean, I think that's an important question to ask.
That makes me think that, like, even if they did a delayed post test on something like this, there could have been so many other factors that intervened that it caused the student, you know what I mean? Like, that student could have been like, yeah, and then I spent the weekend reading a novel in the language and saw X form so many times that, I acquired it, which is obviously not something a student would say, but like, that me they might
Yours
just,
don't.
yeah, my students are not just like, I was interested in acquiring some conjugations over the weekend. If my student said that, I'd be like, please. Please don't become me. Like, don't do it. No, but I think, like, yeah, I think there's so many factors that they could have just got more input. And these students were getting tons of language. They're immersion students, right? So they're getting content. They're getting small talk with the teacher. They're getting like French language arts lessons, you know what I mean, that are focused, kind of on thematic stuff. And, like, what is it? Like, any part of that could have really contributed to any repairs. Like, it would be hard to pin it down for being that it being that like the feedback did it. And I think that that would be a hard, I think it'd be a hard thing to find in general, which makes me sit back now and be like, dang, we think so much about corrective feedback and how to give the best feedback such that students make the change. And it's like, well, they're not even uptaking it. Like, the one that made me giggle a little bit is like sometimes explicit correction is literally when you just tell the kid, like, it's this. And in this study, 50% of the students who received that explicit feedback didn't do anything with it. Like, they didn't repeat the form, they didn't say it correctly after that or whatever. And 14% of the students who received that sort of feedback, like, still did it, quote unquote, wrong, right? Like, the teacher told them directly, you have to say this. And, 12% or 14% of the time, the kid was like, not a lot, like, still doing it in the non-target form, right? So I'm like, dang, we spent so much time thinking about this. I was like, maybe. Just focusing on more comprehensible input and more level appropriate interaction is a more beneficial, a more efficient use of our time. Because again, I'm like, dang, with all of these interventions and all of these, direct feedbacks and just in not a lot of juice from that berry, I guess. I'm looking to like, I'm thinking about a lot of what I've learned about the proficiency levels and the performance descriptors and stuff. Talk a lot about the who they're talking to. So if your like interlocutor is somebody who is used to speaking with non-natives or something like that, essentially us, right? And that novices and intermediates can be have very non-target forms, very non-native like forms, but still be comprehensible to a speaker who is either used to that or like slightly used to that and just kind of sympathetic. Like people will understand, using a language, people will just understand you. You know what I mean? They might be judging you for your form because of their priors or whatever, but they'll probably understand what you're trying to convey. And so again, if that's the thing, I would want students to be more fearless and more excited about trying to speak to somebody who is friendly to them and could, keep talking to them in comprehensible language versus having them be so fearful and wanting to be error-free and perfect and whatever, such that they don't go out and seek, someone to talk to, that they, are so afraid of using the language based on their experience that they can't make it to beyond intermediate to advanced because they just don't put themselves in those scenarios because again, they have associated it with correction. They've associated language use with being wrong and incompetent.
And that makes me think of like one of the biggest lessons about language learning, which is for me when I was teaching English in Japan as a foreign language, and just all the different observations that I made. And one of the biggest ones was the number of teachers at the school who, went to university, studied English since, middle school, some of them elementary school, all through high school, all through college. and knew a lot about the language, but because the lessons were taught in such a, grammar focused, like explicit correction kind of fashion, were terrified of using the language to communicate. And then I saw that, like when I went into the classroom and worked with teachers who did that, their students didn't talk a whole lot. And then the teachers who were more communicative and more, I don't know, focused on just getting meaning, focused on meaning rather than, especially with beginners, giving them such explicit corrective feedback, they were talking more. And I was like, huh, that's really interesting. And then I came back to the United States and, started learning more and learned why that was happening, basically. So that was, yeah, just a huge takeaway for me.
All right. Are we ready to talk to Girl Boss our corrective feedback? Wonderful. So I've got a couple things in my head about like how I've taken this and how I think it's been successful in my class. I think the easiest to understand without like video representation is probably using Write and Discuss as a starting point of corrective feedback, because that's like we're writing something together that we need to edit it as we go, right? So I don't want to have to put everything, I type my stuff because I've got horrible handwriting. So I don't want to type everything and then have to go back, oh, well, we should have said this here. And like, not, let's not fix it in a moment. Let's like just let everyone, let's just pile up, which actually might not be a bad idea. I don't know. I'm gonna think on that one. But so typically what I do though is like when, especially in level four, in level one, I might guide them to the output that I think they might be ready for. So maybe that's just a word or maybe it's a phrase. So like we told a story about someone being scared of a mysterious package. And so I thought they were ready for maybe like to produce tiene miedo, like is scared. So like so we were telling the story and it was something like Bob, and then I paused with my class, tiene miedo. And if a student said like tango, because we had been using tango miedo de, like I'm scared of everything, like oh yeah, ooh. Should I say Bob tiene miedo or Bob tango miedo? So like just in the moment, and like with Spanish 4, they're just producing everything to me. So like I'm taking it like sentence at a time, and we, when a student says something, I still do the exact same thing. Like if they say something, we were working on writing recommendations for things, for illnesses. So we showed a pic, I put a picture of, and I said, describe the problems and what should we recommend? So like the recommendation, I recommend that he take two Tylenol and rest. So when the student said, recomiendo que toma dos pastillas, I'm like, ooh, are we gonna say toma or tome? Dos pastillas. For non-Spanish speakers, like I recommend that he takes two pills. That needs to be tome instead of toma because it's subjunctive. So letter difference, but students weren't ready to produce that yet. But we had talked about it enough in class that they understood why I was correct, why I was changing it, which also takes me to using a lot of pop-up grammar when talking about things a lot will make it easier, make an easier jump to doing some of this correction in the moment, because I can tell students like, oh, remember we're changing that from an A to an E because it's a recommendation. And then like I can give them that in terms they understand instead of saying, oh, well, it's the subjunctive, so we need to start with the yo form, take off the O, and if it's an AR verb, it gets an E. If it's an ER or IR verb, it gets an A. But if it's a stem change, if it's a stem changing verb, don't forget to stem change. Oh, and tango has a G, so make sure that stays there too. So like rather than going into all of this explanation of like how to get it, we've already done the work with pop-up grammar throughout the year, saying like, oh, we're doing this because of this, and then we move on. So it just makes it, I think, easier to have those moments when you do want to help a student correct whatever it is that they said. So those are a couple things that I do. And so essentially, if you're going to correct, maybe give choices, at least so that, because if we are in a classroom where students do know rules, and maybe they've already had some practice with it, then they could maybe go through all the steps. It's like, oh, it's subjunctive, and then go, okay, drop the O, blah, 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 all that. But if for students in classes where the main explicit grammar teaching is from pop-up grammar, then we need to speak to them in terms they understand.
Totally. Yeah. And it's like it's like, what is the focus of your class? Is it that perfected grammatical accuracy and description of grammar features and functions and blah, blah, blah? Or is it like to learn stuff about the world, to learn stuff about each other, to talk about yourself, to talk about the people you care about? Totally. I'm so glad you mentioned pop-up grammar because I went to Bill's presentation about pop-up grammar at ACTFL last year and it was lovely. And I think that that is a great way to speak to the languagey nerds in our class who are like us, who like that sort of thing. And, you know, grammar conveys information in some way, right? So like that is not an inessential part, right? Like that, you know, that conveys who's doing what and when and how and that sort of thing. But it has meaning. It has meaning more than anything. I was thinking about that your tengo versus tiene thing of like I have versus he or she or it has, about how like especially at the early stages that students are acquiring those conjugations more as vocabulary anyways, right? Like they're not learning it as like the O means this and the E means this and then galaxy brain, right? Like your brain is actually just being like tango means I have and tiene means he, she, it has, the end. Like that's all it's got. And then it's from the repeated exposure to all sorts of different forms that your brain starts to be able to do the kind of generalizing that we do as native speakers in our own language or languages in which we're like advanced speakers anyways. Yeah, I think this is the avenue for these sorts of things. I have asked my upper level kids before, kind of like on a beginning of the year survey, like, what do you want me to go in on? Like, what do you want help with? And I think this applies maybe more towards like writing, is like asking them what sorts of feedback they want in the writing. Like, I got this from Meredith White of like, do you want me to go in and like pow, 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 pow through the errors? Like, do you want me to just highlight the places where you did something really creative with the language and tried really hard? Do you want me to only highlight parts that I couldn't understand? Or do you just want the rubric grade? Because some kids are rolling into class just trying to get a grade, you know, and trying to get in and get out. They, you know, it might not be their passion to learn German, and that's fine. So they just want the rubric grade and that's all they want. But then there are some kids who are like, yes, I want all of my endings to be perfect. I think giving them that choice opens up those conversations for you to be like, yeah, I'm not going to correct you because ultimately I just want you to like say stuff and like tell me things about your life and learn about the world with me. But it also opens the door for those kids who want to make those little corrections, those little things here and there. And maybe it helps them notice it such that they can acquire it better. I don't know about that. But it's the choice, I think, to also saves you from souring the relationship of kind of like I said earlier, like offering the feedback that no one asked for.
And it's
Yeah.
kind
And that's
of,
really like, oh, I was just gonna say,
sorry,
like, it's
you
really
could.
the difference between oral and written feedback. Because when you're given written feedback, you have the opportunity to differentiate in that way. Versus, we've talked about the different kinds of oral corrective feedback you can give, and like they're really developmentally and, you know, based on the individual student, you may not be able to give a different kind of feedback that would be effective for them. So, yeah, it's just something else to think about. Bill.
I lost
And okay, so one more thing though, actually, is
it.
that this is making me think about input processing theory, you know, and like the whole primacy of meaning. Learners are focused on the meaning of the words before they notice the forms that are different. And there's something else that we said that made me think about that. Offering choices that lowers the cognitive load so that they don't have to think as much about why it is, you know, incorrect, and you're just giving them the chance to just notice that in this particular context, because it's a recommendation or whatever, this is the correct form. And that's all they really need to know a lot of times. So.
Any final thought before we head out?
Oh, I have one final thought, and it's about
What is it, Ben?
I would love to tell you, Bill. Thank you for asking. I'm here to offer some feedback to our listeners that if you have not registered for Comprehensible Midwest, you best correct that post haste. So we are still huge fans of, we loved talking last week to Marta, and we want you to go to Comprehensible Midwest and learn lots of things, how to provide compelling, comprehensible input in a way that helps your students acquire language boost rockets on their proficiency, et cetera. And the CIMS crew is just a lovely, lovely bunch. I am jealous that I'm, glued to the West Coast over here and can't quite make it out there. But we want you to go. And as such, we gently remind you of the discount code that you could use to save 15% on a registration at Comprehensible Midwest. And that discount code is CISLAYYYS15. CI Slays 15. We'll have that in the show notes as well to make sure that you can get that discount. And as Marta said last week, and as we've received more contact from our friendos over at CI Midwest, is that they have all sorts of discounts. If you're registering multiple people from a department, if you're there's all sorts of things. So it sounds really affordable. It sounds great. There are tracks based on where you're at in your CI learning journey and stuff like that. I'm geeked out. I wish I could go. But if you haven't registered and you are in the vicinity, get hop two. I'm correcting you with this feedback. So
And we hope that you uptake it.
you better uptake. If there was no repair, we're gonna have an issue. So peace and blessings. Thanks, y'all. Go slay.